Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Redding, but my friends call me Spanners. So, let's be friends. I'm joined by Matt Two Rumpets for this special mailbag episode. But firstly, great job on the banned text segment with Kyle on Friday.
Thank you. As you can tell from listening, I think we had more than a little bit of fun recording it.
The biggest compliment I can give you is that I listened to most of it, nearly.
Yes, and we are delighted to be part of the MCU now. The map content universe.
Yeah, and I'm hoping a lot of the other panelists are going to take that mantle and run with it so we can get lots of interesting chat. I could tell that you guys were very passionate about that subject. So go and check out the magazine show on Friday. If you missed it, we caught up with Engine Mode 11. He's Red Bull Fosse. And we also caught up with the Junior Series content from Sam from Formula Nerds as well. But we are going to have a special star guest on this mailbag episode to lend us some legitimacy. But firstly, I just want to say thank you. We've had a huge amount of emails lately. I do try and sit down to respond to them. I'm a little bit behind lately, but I will catch up. But while I was being sick last week and very brave about it, your emails and DMs did keep me company. I never feel like I'm alone just yelling into the universe in a shed. I always feel like I'm right in the middle of an amazing community of F1 fans and podcast listeners. So please keep emailing us at Spanners and Matt. So Spanners at MissedApex.net, Matt at MissedApex.net, or DM me at SpannersReady. We are still an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. Okay, so we are going to add an air of legitimacy and authority to the mailbag by adding a panelist that has stood on the Le Mans 24-hour podium, has competed at the top of the F1 feeder series ladder, has driven every type of race car on the planet throughout history, and now lends his voice to the commentary booth as well. It's F1 TV commentator and sports car driver Alex Brundle. Hi, Alex.
Hello, guys. I tell you what, legitimacy all over the place. You've added a couple of stings since I was last on. Gorgeous front end to the show. Well done.
We try our best. All the hard work is done by one single Australian, so we have really driven efficiency here in the podcasting shed. But speaking of driving, you're going to be competing in the final round of WEC in the 8 hours of Bahrain in just a few weeks. How's the prep going for that?
Yeah, looking forward to it. I'm going testing, actually, in a couple of days. European Le Mans Series team, same team as race with me in the World Endurance Driver Championship, but I'm not, obviously, part of that lineup. Just finished a race in Portugal. I'm heading out to Portugal. They're going to stay on, do a test, get ready for the final round of the World Endurance
Championship. Where did you race in Portugal?
We did not race in Portugal. The World Endurance team didn't, but my same enterprise, my same team, are there. for a different series. So they're staying on, I'm heading out, and we're gonna do some testing.
You really stuck with that world endurance stuff, even though it takes ages for a race.
Eight hours
on the Grand Prix circuit at Bahrain as well.
Yes, Grand Prix circuit in Bahrain. Same venue as used for Formula One. I love it. It's great racing, race through the night, race all the way through the day. There's plenty of time to get your head around it. You know, you don't have to rush.
You can just relax.
Sit back, relax, enjoy.
Is that track, the Bahrain Grand Prix track, from video games, because that's all I've got, Mr. Brundle, is always like a really good one. It feels like a proper racetrack, and it's produced some of the best F1 racing as well. What's it like to go around there? Because, I mean, you're in cars that are pretty up there on the speed and handling in sports car terms.
Yeah, it's a tricky track, and it's a really hard track specifically for endurance racing, because you have that kind of crazy tire degradation that we always expect to see from Formula One. We always expect to see from feeder series, and guess what? It's just the same in a sports car. To drive an endurance car there takes an incredible amount of tire management. You've got to be really intelligent about the way you go about driving the car. And it's always an interesting challenge. Super hot as well inside the bubble of an endurance car.
Oh, I bet. Is it like IndyCar you get? They've got that hose, haven't they, on the back of the helmet that pipes cold air into the helmet. Have you got anything
that? We've got air con units in the cars, except they work all the time apart from when it's hot. when it's really hot, the aircon unit tries a little bit too hard and sort of gives up and just starts blowing air, not cold air. And then there is a regulation about how hot the cockpit temperature can be, but it relates to the ambient. So as the ambient goes up, so theoretically, if you're operating with a 40 degree ambient, the cockpit temperature of about 50 degrees is fine. No one minds. We just have to carry on.
How much does that affect you as a driver? Because you've driven a lot of single seaters as well. And when the drivers, like recently at Singapore, they all talk about just the suffocating heat of it. How much can you put that out of your mind, or is it with you for like a whole 2 hour stint?
No, it can really get to you. You've got to actively calm down. One of those things where you have to just accept, this is how it's going to be now for the next little while. And I'm completely okay with this, even though this doesn't feel great. Because as soon as you start to chastise the temperature and get angry at the heat, it just makes you hotter and more unhappy. So you just got to kind of let it be.
The only comparison I have is NBC, like chemical attack suits, where it's a charcoal layer and then you've got like a protection chemical layer and you're just boiling inside your suit with a respirator gas mask, probably similar to how it feels in a helmet. With every breath you take out, it returns you get rewarded for breathing out with just this wall of air on your eyes.
Well, that's a proper vibe with you being just saving the world like that. I mean, we're not saving any lives. We're just driving around in circles, mate. So
I don't want to overemphasize the effect I had turning a few spanners. But how's things are going in the broadcast world as well? Because obviously it's amazing to hear you, having heard you at a Missed Apex event calling our little kart races on occasion, and then suddenly you're on the world feed transmitting to, especially in this era with so many new fans, like you're the voice of F1 to so many people. I think you've done one race this year, haven't you, for the F1 main feed?
Yeah, I was out at Zandvoort on F1 TV. I'd love to do a little bit more of that. It threw into next year. And then obviously the Formula 2 and the Formula 3. That feels like the bread and butter now, the Formula 2 and the Formula 3. I love doing that. And to call the next. And you get people, contacting you from Formula 1 circles, which is one of the coolest things. You get people contacting you from the Formula 1 circles going, which of these youngsters do you think are good? Because you sort of watch the majority of the races.
Yes.
So actually, you've kind of become I would never claim to be an authority of any kind, but kind of like a gentle reference point for that. And indeed, I meet people all over the world where I've commentated on Formula One and I've been the commentator on Formula One for those people. Not always in the predictable places, because F1 TV kind of scoops up loads of territories and sort of puts them together like Play-Doh, and we broadcast to all of those people. But that's really cool to think that that's the case.
Do you ever get like any sudden surprise visits from people like in airports and stuff like that where you're just like, oh, I'm going to this, and someone like, I know you from somewhere?
Yeah, shall I tell you, it's really weird. And I never had this until sort of really recently. And I think it's a testament to sort of the mass appeal of F1 growing, because, you know, you become, although a very small part of a bigger and bigger and bigger pie, I get people like look at me, and I'm sure it's just my vastly egotistical imagination, but I get people like look at me across, you know, a WH Smith in an airport. And they'll just look at me and you know, not recognize per se, but they've kind of seen you, and they don't really know where they've seen you from, which is, you know, as again, in my imagination of my mind, the reason for that is that they've seen me on an F1 broadcast somewhere. But I'm sure it's
I wonder if you might get recognized from your voice occasionally, though.
A little bit, but most people think that it's just my dad having a difficult day.
I have to admit, we heard you over the tannoy, and everyone turned around and went, "Whoa, that is eerie." But obviously, there's some genetics involved in that. I was at a kart track. I was speaking to someone, and then halfway through the conversation, he suddenly said to me, "He goes, oh, you're Mist Apex. You're the guy from Mist Apex." And I went, "Oh yeah. Oh wow." He went, "Yeah, oh yeah. I recognise that from the voice." And then he went, "Oh, I'm sorry. You must get that all the time." And I went, "Oh yeah, yeah." Well, it's kind of boring, if anything.
It's cool. And it's something that, you know, I'm not used to. It's something that I've seen so much of, obviously, because my dad's still, you know, vastly more recognizable in face and in voice and in word than me. So I've always watched that and watched the kind of
reaction,
character,
I guess,
yeah, and grace with which he dealt with it. So, you know, I very much doubt that I will ever have the same kind of reach, but if I could approach that kind of poise with dealing with that, I would be very thankful indeed.
So first, on Mist Apex, if the question in your head is, should I tell the story? The answer is always yes. Second, and I'm just curious, because you said that occasionally people might mistake you for your dad's voice. Have you ever used that power for fun and profit, let's say?
To get us interviews on Mist Apex, come on.
To be honest, there's a serious house phone problem that we have, which, you know, my parents have still... very much landline, especially living, as is kind of general knowledge, in the area, in the rural area of Norfolk, yeah, in the UK.
For any Game of Thrones fans, it's like the Iron Islands, basically Norfolk still.
Exactly that. And so landline, rather than being a throwback in that area, is more of a necessity. So various over the years, you know, so other family members, it happens less now because obviously I'm not, as you can see, so much at home. But when I have been at home, I've picked up the phone to various personalities who, upon immediately thinking that my father's picked up the phone, have set off, you know. And there's a certain, when somebody starts to tell you about something very, very important, there's a certain inertia to their that you feel rude interrupting.
Yeah, you can't always gain there. Yeah,
exactly. So that's happened a couple of times.
Well, since you brought up that dynamic with your dad, there is one piece of commentary from the Japanese Grand Prix that I can't not mention. And if those of you who don't listen on the Sky Sports commentary, Alex's dad, also known as Martin Brundle, was just telling a lovely, endearing story about a thing his son might have told him. And we're all used to our parents in their 60s and 70s perhaps saying things that might embarrass us or are misinterpreted. But Martin Brundle, your father, definitely implied that you invented the term meatball flag for the mechanical failure flag in F1.
He said I call it that. I'm not an iRacer. I know that a lot of the listeners, yeah, will be an iRacer. I didn't realize that is the official terminology on iRacing for that flag, but it's a really well-known piece of slang for that flag. And I immediately jumped on Twitter and I thought, oh no, people are going to think, you know, they're going to draw a story in their mind of me going,
"You've been at home."
Actually, I call that one. You'll be interested to know that I actually call that. And I just thought, I'm going to nip that straight in the bud.
Actually, Papa, I have a term for the mechanical failure flag. All right, let's get to some of the listener questions. since you are basically a junior series expert, probably one of the foremost junior series experts in media, I think we start there with those questions, Alex. Thing is, you must pick up so much. When you're commentating, you're not only commentating on the action, you're getting emotionally invested in those characters as well, which is something, the reason we have Formula Nerds on to teach us about the junior series is I'm trying to get invested in it because the racing is so good. I want to enjoy it on a drive to survive level as well.
Yeah, I mean, I do get involved with their journey. I try not to get too much involved with their journey because I want to try to stay, totally impartial. they deserve that. I'll let you in on a secret, which is that I have my own racing career and, sponsors and things to do and things to handle. And I can't stay absolutely invested in Formula 2 week in, week out. So there is a period of, and I give a day to it. And sometimes I think it might be better. What I do is I sit down and I catch up with the last period of Formula 2 action and indeed what's been going on in these young drivers' careers. Driver changes, he's gone there, she's gone there, et cetera, and so actually what can be quite challenging are when people do, as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, come up to me and go, who do you like at the moment in Formula 2? And I go, can you wait for the Thursday before the next race weekend when I really get in deep and have a look at all the statistics so I can deliver them in practice on a Friday.
And you know, I bet you could give a good answer, but your own standard for wanting to give an answer is based on post-research.
Yeah. I mean, I can give a good answer, but when I do so, again, I remember how intently when I was at sort of that level and GP3 level, slightly below that, that I watched the commentary, probably too much, actually. It probably wasn't particularly good for my career, but I watched the commentary of those different series. And I always imagine Driver X, with his hand, what about me?
And I saw some commentary from James Hunt. And when he was on the F1 commentary, and he would be saying stuff like, well, that was ridiculous from that driver. He's absolutely no place being a Grand Prix professional and he should leave the sport immediately. Like, he didn't care. Maybe you should invoke some of that.
He'd say that to their face as well, I think. I also try, never say something in commentary about a driver that you wouldn't be prepared to stand in front of them and say. And I think, but that does extend to if you are a character like James Hunt, who would say anything then to anyone's face, then you can get away with quite a lot, can't you, under that rule?
Well, let's go to Stuart's question, who says, with Drogovic not getting a seat, so Drogovic, F2 champion, De Vries not getting a seat straight away and going to FE, and others who only made third place in F2, getting an F1 seat. Does the FIA ladder have broken rungs and is Indy less challenging than F3? That's from Stuart Neal. Thanks for that question. I know there's a few things there, but I think, a lot of people see this, you can't continue once you're champion. So maybe it's like an incentive to finish third. But is that feeder series broken? And I do remember actually sat in you might not remember this. Years ago, you and I sat in an Italian restaurant talking about what the young drivers actually have to consider. Even if they get offered a seat, it might not be the right thing to do, even if that's the dream.
Felipe Drogovic has been scooped up in the Aston Martin young driver program, but I'm not sure how much that is just to stop us all going, well, of course, he's not been affiliated to any driver program, and just scoop him up into that environment. He certainly deserves to be there. I don't want to be drawn on is Indy less challenging than F3 without driving in both series.
Good point.
Right now, I couldn't tell you. Because you never know. I mean, realistically, you never know what kind of pinnacle is being achieved. Professional pace on any specific day at the absolute pinnacle of these series, I would suggest, is about the same. All of these series have their various challenges, but the people who are, there's always someone in that series who's really delivering, 99.9% of the potential of the racing card. So, each of the series has their own challenges. Why have they not got a seat? Is there a broken rung on that ladder? Yes, there is. And it's because I think that, you know, the financial pressures are such that the teams in Formula One no longer believe enough in the validation process of that series. And I think that needs to be addressed. But we know that. We know that. That's you know, nobody's sitting there going, you know, a couple of million quid plus for the feeder series to find from somewhere for the feeder series to F1 is completely okay. Nobody's saying that. So yeah, it's a foregone conclusion, really.
All right. So I have a two-part follow-up. One is about whether or not you think F1 teams are perhaps, and I'm looking now at the return of Alonso, let's say, and now we see De Vries doing well. Yeah. Do you think F1 teams are at a point where, with the cost cap, perhaps they're beginning to value experience and maturity a bit more, whereas in the past it was always about, are you young and you have ridiculous pace? And just a technical note on the IndyCar series, I think they have about double the horsepower of an F3 car. So I would ask, given the horsepower disparity, wouldn't Indy just be simply a harder car to drive for a driver because it has so much more power?
Now, you have to remind us of the first question now.
Okay, let me go back to the first question again. I'm kidding. I'm sure Alex can remember two things.
Yeah, I mean, I think on your second question, it's always important to remember that you're not racing the car, you're racing the others. You know, you're not racing the car, you're not racing the track, you're not racing the day, you're not racing the ambient, you're racing the others. So yeah, okay, you know, the F3 car requires this, the Indy car requires that, so on. But you're only ever required to go slightly quicker than the next quickest guy or girl, indeed. So I think, yeah, I mean, you could argue that one is a harder car to drive, in which case you could argue that the field spread would be greater, and therefore it would be easy to find, it would be easy to get further up the field if you were further away from the pace. Equally, you could argue that the other car is easier to drive and is less of a challenge, and therefore it would be easier to be closer to the pace. But realistically, you know, you're operating in a sport. You're going to have to remind me of the first question, you know, Trumpets, because
I knew it. That, see, Matt.
Oh man, you've made me look bad. I've officially been wrong on the podcast after all these years once.
I'm going to let that go. Remind us of the first question.
The first question was very simple. With looking at Alonso, looking
experience.
At De Vries. Bingo.
Got it. With you. I think there's a big enough pool of drivers where they can actually demand both. But it interests me, and I believe it should interest those in charge of these young driver programs, that actually, you know, not necessarily the appointment of De Vries and the retention of Alonso over such a long period of time, but the performance of De Vries and the performance of Alonso after such a long period of time. And in fact, you know, there was a period where drivers were just getting younger and younger and younger and younger and younger. And I don't really see any reason for that beyond it being a fad, and beyond, you know, teams, if you look at what's just happened with Oscar Piastri, actually teams wanting to move their driver through to Formula One and almost nail them into a Formula One seat so they get their value out of them before they move too far through their career. And I think that could potentially be the driver for that. But if you look in hard performance terms, you know, I was always taught that a race driver peaks around 30. Because you have the experience, plus you might lose a little bit of speed, but realistically, that's your moment.
You're 32, Alex. Drivers are approaching. You're 32. That. Do you feel like you've peaked?
I'm over the hill, man. I'm over the hill. I don't know. I think it's for other people to decide, you know, if you've peaked or troughed or not. I think sports cars is a bit of a different discipline as well. There's a lot more sort of ego burying to be done and sort of general working with others to do. Whereas Formula One is a feisty old game.
Yeah, team sport. Oh man, it must be so annoying when like you do really well and your teammate stuffs it. That's got
I mean, equally, you know, both things have happened. I've had races where I've won the race notionally, and I'm more than happy to say that I, as the strategy worked out, played what I would consider to be a smaller part than usual in that. And then races where I've driven the absolute wheels off the car and my teammates faded to the back. But you got to take the rough with the smooth.
Yes. Right. So actually, just one more question. I think it's a really good question that Stuart's asked there. You've got direct experience of going from junior series and then going to a sports car, and that might be a little bit in your blood. And I very much suspect that you had a little gentle voice in your ear growing up saying sports cars are brilliant, by the way. So that's, you know, that's ferried you into there. Do you think that having, say, your year out like De Vries had, you have a year out, you go to GT, and then suddenly that F1 call comes up. How damaged are you from leaving that conveyor belt, that ladder? So can someone go off and do supercars, Formula E, Le Mans, and then come back and do F1?
I think the proof is in the pudding, really. And, you know, we've seen drivers like Andre Lotterer jumped in Caterham a few years back. And just did a mega job from nowhere. You know, drivers go away and do sort of super formula and that kind of thing. Honestly, you know, you look at a modern sports car program, especially at the highest level, the level above me, although De Vries has been in LMP2 cars for a little while. You're working with Michelin, maximizing a sequence of compounds that are totally totally variable for your demands, you know, a confidential compound. You're working with powertrain analysis. You're giving bits of feedback.
Yeah.
Where does that come into the junior series ladder? You know, you're driving a sequence of Dallara chassis with Renault engines, or then you jump in you find yourself in a 1.6 Mechachrome V6 without a turbo. Then you're in a 1.6 V6 with a turbo. Then, you know, that experience is actually, as you say, trumpets, and it's probably a point towards your previous question, massively beneficial, in fact, when you arrive in the development-rich world of Formula One.
Yeah, well, and I'm always surprised that more people don't point to the power management game required at Formula E. And I know you were hinting at LMP1s there with the massive need to manage your energy system, your recovery system, as well as the tire degradation. I think the biggest advantage to F2 and F3 that I can see is that you're working with the same tires and compounds that you'll be seeing in Formula One. And I think that is a big advantage for a lot of teams, but the rest of it, not so much. You can get that elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, you're working with the same tire tendency. Pirelli tires are, we talk about getting their head around the Pirelli tire. They tend to be quite soft in the sidewall, which gives the tire a very specific feel, and that carried through even, you know, into a GT car with a Pirelli tire on versus a GP3 car. You still had to carry that same feel. So yeah, there is great benefit to that. You get the feel for what it's like to race on a Formula One weekend, which is a big deal, a massively big deal, because it's so much of the time you feel like the racing takes a backseat almost to the furore and the general activity that's going on around. That's something you really have to get used to as a driver. So there are a lot of benefits as well as being marketable to that Formula One environment. But, you know, technically, yes. I mean, you look at the driver of the technical ability of Alonso, the technical ability of Sebastian Vettel or Lewis Hamilton, you know, the old hands, the greats. They've developed that after they've arrived to Formula One, you know, and that's what's happened there.
That is really interesting. I think we've got a really good question that just follows on to this when it comes to feel and moving between cars. We saw you at the Goodwood Festival, and were you racing in Adrian Newey's car? I can't remember which way round it was now. No, Adrian's Newey's car choked out, didn't it, after the driver handover?
Yeah, that would diff. It had a
gearbox
issue,
yeah,
I believe.
Right, yes, but that was good. That was good racing to watch. I love just watching how those cars weren't planted at all. I bet that was great fun. But I'll say Martin's question first, because that will lead on to it. Martin D says, "What do you get more of a kick out of, modern WEC style kit with mega downforce and modern tires, or classic cars and everything that comes with it. And I have to say, like, I have caught like bits of you just sliding around in minis and these classic cars. It does look like it's a handful, gigantic steering wheels at times as well.
I mean, it's as a driving challenge, the classic car is fantastic. You know, what you can do in those cars, you know, you've got to, it's a difference. The reason, by the way, why they slide around like that is because they're on a cross ply tire, which gives grip in like a hill. Whereas a radial tire, like a modern car, will give grip as a plateau. So you've got it and then you've not got it.
Oh,
whereas
right.
A cross ply tire will give grip versus slip angle in like a hill. So you've kind of got it all the time and it comes back and goes away. So that's why you can get away with such slip angle and still go fast in them, which is what makes the racing dramatic and exciting.
Oh, that's interesting. So you'll feel that level of grip and you've got confidence that it will give you a little bit of warning that, like, no, you are pushing the limit here, Alex.
Oh, yeah, you really can go, well, that's not worked out. What can I do about this then? You know, while you're sort of floating through the middle of the corner, which is why, you know, the driving talent of you know, like a Stirling Moss or a Fangio is so unbelievably impressive, because they could wing it basically in these cars and make them work. However, rolling out on the skates with eight guys pulling you outside to then receive your tires to then be dropped on the ground to then, you know, head off into the dark at Le Mans is another unbelievable experience. And I wouldn't, you know, it's not something where I would say I would be happy to give that experience up for anything.
Right. Okay. So the classic cars give you a curiosity and have their own fun and charm and challenge. But when you're in that prototype, you know that you're at the front end.
I love the classic stuff. I love it. I adore it. But it's a connoisseur's type of racing. Yeah, it's a connoisseur's type of racing. What to do once you've done Le Mans? Because to come up to that, to take it to that top level is beautiful.
Okay, so let's talk difficulty. Is there any era of F1 car where you think, okay, Muggins, Spanners might jump in and be okay? So I'm looking at like the 50s ones and go, wow, looking at those lads, you know, they're having to flop their bellies in and they're, you know, they've got a fag on the go and looks like they may have had a few gins, to be honest. I'm fairly sure I can hop in one of those cars and at least operate it. I definitely couldn't operate a modern F1 car. I wouldn't know the first thing to do. I probably couldn't even drop the clutch.
The manual, I can tell you that the manual mechanical skill required to operate a historic F1 car would blow your mind. And not just in the case of, you know, changing gear and so on and so forth, but you're a car manager at that point with such limited information, and you've got to have that innate sense of when it doesn't quite feel right. Sit in the car, no radio, of course, so you've got to work out why. You know, you're keeping the car going. You're a part of it. A modern F1 car, yeah. Matt, you're a fighter pilot. You're a fighter pilot with a team to assist you. Then it's just, you're completely limited by processing power. How much processing power have I got? I firmly believe, and I've seen it done. I've seen it done with people who do, you know, Corsa Cliente days, which is Ferrari's own client-based F1 program. It, with assistance and help, normal people can get, obviously, not at a Formula One driver's level, but normal people can get in Formula One cars and can drive them. It's just a case of how far away from the pace that they would be.
I've seen certain influencers jump in, say, like a Renault F1 experience day, and then pretend that they were, oh, look, Renault have invited me to do a thing. No, you haven't. You've paid $3,000 to jump in. But I've heard on those things, see, I didn't mention any names. That's personal growth, audience. On those days, apparently, they will let you do 3 laps because at 3 laps, that's where people gain enough confidence to hurt themselves. So it's like, yeah, the first couple of laps, you're going slow enough that you're not in any danger. Then by lap 3, you're going, I am Senna.
Well, there's definitely... Is that a statement we're going to end with?
Yes.
I can just imagine you clearly. Is that going out on reels later on?
Okay, you need to watch my iRacing streams, because once I get the VR on and I've got my little force feedback steering wheel, in fact, what we do at our... karting events and when we do our iRacing events, My wife called it race driver karaoke, which I absolutely love because we all get to just grab that race driver mic for an afternoon and pretend and make believe. Don't mock us, Alex.
But I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for that. And there's only one way, you know, you talk about racing school, you talk about, you know, simulation, training, eye tracking. There's only really one way to learn how to do that. And it's the old 10,000 hours is the old 10,000 hours argument. Get out there and learn how to do it. And everyone who has raced at any kind of level has got in a new car at some point, whether it's at Le Mans, whether it's a faster, a single seater, whether it's whatever it is, a British touring car for the first time, and completely winged it until they knew what they were doing. And that's basically the way you learn how to do this. And winging it is actually a very important skill in racing with less and less and less testing over the years.
Oh yeah, no, that's a good point. And that might get even less for certain teams, but that's not a topic we're covering on this week's episode. Let's get to some more listener questions. I think we're going to go into some F1 punditry here, Mr. Brundle. I'm sure that's an area you can stray into.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Lots of questions about Daniel Ricciardo and his situation. He recently came out and did some interviews basically saying, I see what Lando Norris is doing. I can see the difference, but I couldn't recreate it in my car. It's a very difficult situation. So let's just get to the three questions that I have here, and I'll point you to them. I won't expect you to remember them like Matt does. In fact, let's start off one by one. If you were in Danny Rick's position, asks Rob, what would you do? Would you have a sabbatical? Would you try for a Haas Williams seat? Or would you go for another series? I think that's a great just one just to kick off with. What would you do in his situation? You don't have a McLaren drive. Let's say one of those two, Haas or Williams, is hypothetically available. What are you thinking?
Oh, I mean, if he has the opportunity to stay in Formula One, I think he'll take it with both hands. He's already intimated that it's unlikely that he's going to be in a race seat on the F1 grid next year. I think a reserve driver seat he is not for him. I think at his stage of career it's a little bit pointless, really. Realistically, I think he's kind of in that Nico Hülkenberg situation of he's a reserve driver whether he has a reserve driver seat or not. You know, he's one of the drivers who would be called upon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
In realistic terms, and how many times over past years have we seen reserve drivers not actually get in reserve because the teams, when it come down to it, want to use somebody with a bit more experience.
Yeah, well, Susie Wolf was the Williams reserve driver for years, and I think they out and out said, no, we wouldn't actually use her for a Grand Prix. You go, well, what's the point of that reserve driver role? It's almost like you've paid to be on the CV. I don't know.
Indeed. So when you look at Daniel Ricciardo's scenario, I think what I would do, and it's, but the problem with it is it's a brutal decision to make. Mm-hmm. A brutal decision to make. I would commit to another series now.
Really?
You know, there's a lot going on in sports cars. IndyCar goes from strength to strength. It's a great place to go racing. And I think, you know, having been in, you know, you've got Formula One and then you've got rest of world motorsport, haven't you? Having been involved, you can have a fantastic career.
So Danny Rick would be massively popular in IndyCar. And I think I can ask you this question as a driver. Maybe it's an awkward question. A lot of drivers have looked at IndyCar and said, that's frightening. And I look at the ovals and it's frightening. Is that a fair reflection of IndyCar?
Oh, definitely. And there are a lot of drivers that actively say it's not for them. And those drivers do the road course deal, maybe do the Indy 500 if they feel like it, you know, and drivers have hurt themselves a lot out there. Yeah. So it's another decision to make. It's almost an old world decision to make for a race car driver. Am I okay to do this? And that's the reality of the series. But drivers know when they undertake, you know, oval racing, that they have a level of risk that they're prepared to take. But it's not the only other series you can jump into.
So 100% risk aside, if you had to take a year out of Formula One and you wanted to be in the best shape when you knew you were going to come back next season.
Good question. Yeah.
Which series would you pick to keep yourself as sharp as possible?
Yeah, no, it's either IndyCar or Super Formula. Because you need to be in a high powered, and you need to be in a high powered single seater. You know, a high powered single seater is its own skill, just like driving a sports car is its own skill, just like being great in a TCR car or a GT car is its own skill. You need to stay, of course, in that box if you possibly can, and be on the floor. You can't, of course, go back for Formula Two. There are regulations that set against it, so you would have, you know, IndyCar is the obvious choice.
Follow up, would you change that Formula 2 regulation, or would you create another series where former champions from Formula 2 could race?
No, I don't think so, because I think that you've had your opportunity to deliver in Formula 1. You either have or haven't done so. You know, we have seen drivers head out into the wings. You know, what's a real shame, in fact, I think, is that DTM no longer exists in its previous form. Because that was a great place where Formula One drivers sought manufacturer-funded refuge, you know, for a year out and a year back, maybe.
Talent-based seats as well, I guess.
Yeah, indeed. And the cars were fast enough where, you know, you got basically a GT500 style of, or, you know, silhouette.
They had downforce.
Yeah, proto GT, you know, is the way that I always describe the cars. You know, you're going what is quicker than a second tier prototype. And indeed, now with the hypercar regulations, almost as quick, if not as quick, as a top tier prototype. And you're racing against F1 level talent. Now it's a GT3 car. Yeah, it's a bit different. You know, we saw Alex Albon thrown into that, you know, conceptually, and he wasn't really interested in undertaking that challenge. And I can understand that, really.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend to Daniel Ricciardo to join our Missed Apex karting series. I still have waking nightmares of when Mr. Brundle was kind enough to join us. I think the first time you joined us, and then one of our panelists sent you quite close to the barrier, and I still have nightmares where I wake up and go, rude! Mr. Brundle's a guest! Why have you done that? Feel bad. It's not been back since. If you came back to a Missed Apex karting series, I can't even promise you that you wouldn't get punted. There's an awful lot of punty drivers on the panel. Sorry.
Yeah, you really have to be careful how you phrase that, don't you?
Pronounce all your letters, please.
Correctly.
I formed the words in my mouth. I'm a professional broadcaster, sir. There's another really good question from Sean, which says, the recent articles around Danny Rick and him not having the same feel as Lando in that McLaren, what is the feel he's lacking and how do you find it as a driver?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the statement he made before, you know, I can see it in the data, but I can't do it. That is a driver gently suggesting his car's not the same. And I think that's pretty clear. You know, drivers like all different kind of sensations from the car, not just beyond oversteer or understeer. You know, in terms of how quickly a car breaks away, how the front sinks when they're on the brake pedal. Some drivers like a soft, compliant front end. They can be very aggressive. Yeah. And it's all about how he specifically undertakes driving the car that just doesn't work with that McLaren.
When the gap is that big between two top-rated drivers, do you start to go, well, this can't just be the out-and-out difference between those two guys? Or is there a chance that Ricciardo is a journeyman hack and Lando Norris is a savant future, you know, Schumacher?
I don't think that there's any chance of that. You know, you look at the things that Daniel Ricciardo's done behind the wheel of a Formula One car over the years, and you know, he gets the job done. I think what it does show you is when you're operating at such a pinnacle, and it's something that I really think is a factor of that sort of single seater racing and a factor of the higher echelons of single seater racing. Things can be not that bad, but look horrible, purely because the level achieved the rest of the time and otherwise is so unbelievably high that once you fall off that cliff of performance and lose that confidence, it looks outrageous in comparison to everybody else. A bit like a sort of an offside defense when everyone steps up and looks like you're miles offside, but you're actually only just.
I would actually say, Alex, that it's more like a radial loss of grip than a cross-ply loss of grip, I would say.
Indeed. Yeah, and you would be correct. Rubbish and disastrous is what it looks like, but it's not. It's just the pinnacle of performance, the knife edge.
One of the interesting things I think Ricciardo had said in one of his interviews was that one of the big differences is that Norris has grown up with this McLaren. And as we all know, faults tend to follow chassis through multiple developments and regulations, which I think McLaren has admitted that they have some problems with this year's car that they had with last year's car. So is it also possible that because he came into this team and has grown up with this car and with this power unit, which I will point out, this is the first time Mercedes power unit has been driven by Daniel Ricciardo, that also plays into the gap we see?
Yeah, I mean, it's a case of philosophy that tends to follow teams and a generality of how they go about trying to extract performance from a racing car and how they go about trying to design a racing car to deliver performance. McLaren, I've always considered as the all-rounders, really. They kind of come at it from different angles, but there will be a specificity to how they, you know, how they aim, how that group of engineers, of course, which is always fluid, aim to gain performance. But there's also a confidence there and a line of communication, you know, for Lando to feed back into and tell those engineers what he wants. And it, you know, even in a feeder series scenario, you get, you know, you pick up a car the year after the driver who was before you. And this is when, you know, you're dealing with all spec Dallara parts, even, you know, you pick up a car and it has the tendency of the driver who left it to you the year before. So taking that a development further and looking at a car which they are developing from basically scratch as per this year's regulations, as per the regulation revolution that we had at the beginning of this year, and you start to see how Lando has rubber stamped it,
he's made it his team. I think, in a way, made it his team. They had two kind of superstar level on reputation drivers. And I think now they're in a better situation because they've got Lando, their established superstar, and then a Padawan learner. And that's how I would set up my F1 team as well.
It's going to be tough for Piastri to come into that team. And after all after the interesting moment the F1 world had where they expected him to turn up in one place and he didn't, and everyone had quite a lot to say about it. Now the pressure is indeed on to perform. I mean, we've seen him. He's a world-class racing driver. In those series, he's got to learn extremely fast the ways and methods of Formula One and deliver in the short term.
Which answers Nick's question. So that saved us that. But thank you for that question, Nick. How will Piastri cope, Matt?
Well, that was what I was going to point to. This is on everyone's bucket list of your personal opinion. Will he be able to cope at that level?
It's interesting, isn't it? And, you know, I cite Yuki Tsunoda, who jumped from, you know, a successful feeder series career, jumped in a Formula One car and went, there are just so many buttons to press. You know, he's demonstrative, isn't he? And he tells you exactly what's going on.
Mouth on his sleeve. Said, I love it.
Yeah. There's just so many buttons to press and I don't know which one to press first. And it's a big deal. And, you know, far from actually, you know, you take a, okay, they've got two compounds in Formula Two, but then, you know, you're not dealing with the optimized car, the tools that the engineers have to fiddle about with things like the energy that the car is putting into the tire and how it's working. The compound are so limited. So you have to do that yourself as the driver rather than feed back to the engineer what it's doing and get them to make the car perfect for you. It is a change. It is a change. Electronic diff changes, brake migration changes, all of those elements that are so in depth that demand an intelligence from the driver, which is not required until that moment. It's going to be tough for sure.
Alex, I've got a couple of questions left from the listeners that I'd love to put to you. Do panic and put, if you've got a hard out, make a wild hand signal or send me a DM. But there's one quick question and one that's a little bit more involved. But before we go, thank you so much for your time. I have enjoyed a lot of your YouTube content, genuinely, that you've put out. I like watching you tinkering, building your sports cars. There's a brilliant video of you and your dad doing the green hell, taking on the Nürburgring. And I just loved seeing your guys' relationship around there. It's like every father and son kind of going on a wild adventure. It's almost like a fishing trip, except it's like these magnificent machines going around this gigantic historic racetrack. So point us to all your content that you're doing at the moment.
Yeah, so a lot of it's kind of classic car based. We're building classic cars and then going and racing those mostly all over the UK. But we were out in Spa for the Spa 6 hours. Last one was a GT40 tool room replica that we finished a day before the Spa 6 hours. Those videos are going to come out soon. Brundle Behind the Wheel is where you find all of that nonsense of me banging my head against my Mustang, literally, and trying not to bleed too much all over it. And then doing some classic racing as well. So that's on YouTube. And then obviously I'm Alex Brundle Racing on Instagram.
And our patron Slack group is asking if you will drop in at some point and do a text, answer me anything. And if you say yes, that means I get to entice people to be patrons, Alex.
Okay, yes. That's become like patrons.
Some mutual
whatever the stipulations are, whatever he demands from you, become patrons.
Patreon.com/MissedApex. Alex Brundle demands it. Here's a good question from John M's got a great question about street circuits. However, this one from Jake is really good. You guys do an amazing job. That's us, Alex. You're not included in that. I'm so happy that I found your podcast. He says, my wife and I are going to the Circuit of the Americas. What is your advice for making the most out of a weekend? Keep up the good work. We wish you the best. And actually, I can't answer that because I have very little experience of going to live circuits. And also, I feel like you probably couldn't answer that question very much either, Alex. But I wanted to ask the question as an excuse to ask you, can you just turn up at a Grand Prix if you're not working that weekend?
Can I or can one?
Yeah, just, yes, no, yeah, you. I just go into the general admission and just be like, I'm just chilling out at Stowe.
No, I absolutely can. And in fact, you know, I was at the Monaco Grand Prix this year to do another job. I actually got myself a job so I could go to the Monaco. It's probably more realistic.
Nice.
So I could go to the Monaco Grand Prix this year, doing some presenting for a corporate thingy. And I basically said to F1, well, I'm there. you know, would it be possible to get a pass? And they were kind enough to help me with
okay,
one.
Okay, but have you ever gone, right, I'm doing general admission?
And no, I have. Yeah, no, yeah. Absolutely, I have. Yeah, British Grand Prix a couple of times before I was a member of the BRDC. I have gone as a general admission fan, and very, very much enjoyed it. Circuit of the Americas. If you're the main, I have some points on the Circuit of the Americas, which Brilliant. Are mainly to do with COTA. I'm reticent to say make sure you get a grandstand ticket or make sure you sit in a certain place, because I recognize how expensive these things are modern times. I don't know what you're working with in terms of wherewithal. If you're Texan already, which I suspect you are, if you're going, then you know how hot it is. So make sure that you're prepared for it to rain very hard and be very hot, because those are the two things I've seen happen at the Circuit of the Americas. So dress the conditions, drink lots of water. And I think talk to people and make friends, because I think that F1 is a community, isn't it? And people that like racing and want to talk about it are cool people. And I think that actually, rather than just going and sort of, you know, watching, you know, Verstappen and Hamilton go and Charles Leclerc go round and round and round, if you hang out with some other like-minded people, then you'll learn a lot more about racing.
Yeah, and my tip would be to get absolutely melted. Just go to the bar, get a skinful, because that's what me and Brad did at the Silverstone Grand Prix last season. And yeah, we just made loads of friends randomly, because all the people there share the same interests as you. And generally, they've either gone there on their own, which I've done before, or with a couple of other people. So it's not like a closed like clique. It's not Mean Girls. No one's going to say, you can't sit with us. Just talk about racing. Yeah. Well, the thing is, COTA, yes, very hot. Silverstone's hot enough for me. My greatest fear with those kind of events is not having enough to eat, not having... So you've got to basically treat it like camping, haven't you? You go, right, I've got my sunscreen, I've got my water, I've got my provisions for the day, I know where the restrooms are.
Well, yeah, and also acknowledge that, in fact, whilst you go and watch... Formula One is an incredible spectacle to watch from trackside.
Yeah.
It is not the most demonstrative sport in terms of what is going on if watched from a very specific place on a very specific racetrack. Worth doing so because, wow, look at that thing going really fast.
Yeah.
We'll mesmerize you all day. If you're lucky enough to see some action happen on your corner, even better. Yeah. However, it's worth making sure you have some method, depending on your region or era or your region or which part of the world you're in, of making sure you know what's actually happening in the race will increase your enjoyment immensely of watching the cars go really fast.
So I was at Village, turn three at Silverstone in the grandstand, and there's a huge big screen in front. And that was 2013 when all the tyres were blowing up down the Wellington Straight. So in that situation, yeah, you can see them come past. It's brilliant. And hearing the cars coming down the gears into that turn three. So Abbey, then the left-hander, and then coming down the gears into the tight right-hander is spectacular to hear those engines straining against the driver's ambition to lose speed. But also, I think in general, like on the sort of budget I'm operating at, I think if you offered me, you know, the tickets to go to Spa or Monza, I would want to go, right, Friday, experience all the support races and the practice, watch them going by. Saturday, watch the qualifying somewhere near the start-finish line, and then go home for Sunday and watch it on telly. Because to me, the race is still very much a TV sport. Matt?
I was just going to get in with, I love that you have to specify the year the tires were exploding.
Oh, right,
because it's
okay.
Happened more than once at Silverstone.
Okay, but that was happening an awful lot at Silverstone. Yes, okay, I think that's a great question from Jake. And I think like a lot of F1 fans, we haven't spent a lot of time at the track. We talk a big game, but mostly we're on the sofa annoying our Dutch neighbours. Okay, that might have been very specific to me. John M. asks, take a circuit like Monaco or Silverstone, leave everything the same, except the walls, and add infinite runoff. How much faster would the drivers be? Obviously, they can't. We're going to police the track limits here, but I think the question is, how much of a psychological effect do the walls have?
Wow, that's a great question.
It is a great question, isn't it? Well done, John.
That is a great question. I mean, the easy out on that is obviously you've got Monaco, the walls delineate the track width. And so actually, because you only have to keep two wheels on the tarmac, they would actually extend the width of the circuit considerably. I feel like that's a cheaty answer because it doesn't drive towards the point of the question, which is how much does having a physical barrier slow the driver down? I think it would blow your mind how much longer it took the drivers to get up to speed. Then it would sequentially blow your mind how close they were to the eventual speed once they got there. So I think what you're dealing with is a period of time that it's going to take the driver to get up to speed, but essentially, 99.9% as quick. It's just, but bigger field spread. The pinnacle would be broadly the same. The drop away would be greater, and the time taken to achieve that would be greater.
Yeah. So, like, do you have an experience of tracks where the walls have made you go, like, say, on a first practice, made you go, "Ooh, actually, I'm not sure I fancy this an awful lot."
Well, I mean, Monaco is extreme in that way. Not necessarily the walls, but, you know, they're racing in America, racing in IMSA gives you a different standard for what constitutes runoff, aka there is none, or it's bumpy, or you just wouldn't want to be there. And so that is just like a hard limitation. And yes, you know, I have been to frightening racetracks.
Name them.
But, oh, I mean, Road Atlanta is a frightening racetrack. Yeah. NOLA, I did a test at New Orleans Raceway, not NOLA, while they were busy getting it ready for IndyCar, and there was a digger sitting on the outside of Turn 7. It's a different standard. Yeah. It's a totally different standard.
Well, actually, if we can start with Road Atlanta, because I've played it on a video game, so I'm basically the same as you. The undulation and the fact that you've got blind corners and blind apexes, how much does that make a difference? Because me, as a complete rank amateur, for me, it's an adventure every time. So on the blind crest of turn two, I never take that corner the same way twice. As a racing driver, are you able to tune in even when that information isn't available to you? Visually.
Yeah, somehow it works. And what's even trickier is in the dark when you take all those reference points away and then the lights can't even see down the road. So like something like, I think the turn you'll be thinking of is turn three in Atlanta, where you go through the first one very fast over the top of the hill. And then that right 90 comes and slaps you in the face. Muscle memory takes over. And what's really weird is you'll not do that racetrack for 4 years and then you'll go back. And because that muscle memory is in there somewhere, somehow you know where to turn in. It's extremely strange.
So, like, just to get back to the street tracks, if I'm understanding it correctly, if I'm on a track with lots of runoff, I'm learning it from the outside in. But if I'm on a street track with walls, I'm learning it from the inside out, and that takes a bit longer.
Correct. And it's so interesting when you see American drivers come to Europe and then European drivers come into America, because I'm going to cite Romain Grosjean to start with. Goes out to IndyCar. And what European drivers do when they go to America is go very fast and then crash a lot, because they they get out there and they go, "I'm going to race this track like it," because our way is to go out there and do the lap, because that's what's required of us in the Junior Series.
So I'm assuming you have a data point more than Grosjean for that.
Yeah, multiple data points. Drivers, he's just the most high profile one in recent times. Drivers who go over and do IMSA, I've seen 100, you know, young European sports car drivers go and do IMSA and just do the same thing. What's interesting is when American drivers come to Europe, they drive to artificial limits. So in fact, they build up unnecessarily.
I just remember an article from Andrew Benson about 8 years ago. It just popped into my head, and he was saying, one of the signs of how Lewis Hamilton is great, and I think he said the same similar thing of Sebastian Vettel, is how they go out there and basically go off track and abuse track limits because you can, and then they draw back in.
Why would you not? Yeah. I mean, you know, why would you not go out there? If turn 12 has a long runoff, why would you not go out there and break 5 meters too late, go 5 meters off, then bring it 5 meters back? Is that not a faster way of achieving your objective, which is to break at exactly the right point, than breaking 100 meters early, then 50 meters early, then 25 meters early? Because look, man, we've not got a lot of time. You put a Formula 2 driver out on the track. He's got 40 minutes to learn the track, get the car right, find out which compounded tire does what, give his feedback, and put a lap in to get confidence for the session. there is just not the time to go and trial and build up. And that's when I say, you know, when in fact you look at these circuits with great runoff and they say, you know, that piece of runoff needs to be changed because it means that the drivers are abusing that piece of runoff and coming back on the circuit and having an accident. It's not that piece of runoff specifically ever. You know, you don't take these things in isolation. What you've got is a broad culture built of the way that totally racetracks are designed and built and operated now that give the drivers conceptually, in a way which has quite a lot of inertia, the sense that they're safer than they are. And I think that's the issue we have with dangerous things happening on racetracks, specifically in Europe, it must be said, in relation to tarmac runoff.
So the reason I love that question so much was because it irritates me when people say Hungaroring is Monaco without the walls. And I just go, no, it's such a completely different kind of racetrack.
Yeah, it is. It is a different kind of racetrack. There is a little space around Hungaroring. You know, you can go deep in turn one and sort it all out. You know, Monaco without the walls is not really when you think, I can understand what they're trying to say. I can understand what they're trying to say, but when you look at it from that perspective, not really a legitimate comment, because that's like saying a football pitch without the lines, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, that.
It's like the walls are Monaco. That's the point.
A massive thank you to Alex Brundle for giving up his time to answer your mailbag questions. Go and follow him by searching Alex Brundle on Twitter, and make sure you follow him on YouTube. Search for Alex Brundle. You will not regret searching out his content. We're going to be back for the race review for the Circuit of the Americas. It's going to be very late at night. I think we're not starting our race review until 1 a.m. However, we will still have your race review ready for your Monday morning commute. Follow Matt at MattPT55. Follow me at Spanners Ready. I'm the best one. Until next time, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex Podcast.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.